Okay, let's pray. Father, thank you for this glorious day. Thank you for, the second week of Christian Ed, but it feels nice to be coming back to church to have 2 hours to worship you, maximizing our time in your presence on your day, the Lord's Day. So, Father, I'd ask that you would be with us this morning while we worship you with our minds through Christian formation hour. Open our ears to hear your voice. Allow us to perhaps learn some new things that we haven't thought about in the past. And most of all, on the important topic of evangelism, quicken our hearts to respond to your great commission. Lord, I would ask that your Spirit would pour out on this particular congregation and that we would see a mighty work of you, whereby we see lost sheep come back into the fold. Also, we would see new converts baptize new members into our church. So, Father, I ask that you would be with us and you would be magnified and glorified during this hour. In Jesus' name I pray. Amen. Okay, so this week we're on we didn't finish. We had a lot of chatting, which is great. So we're just continuing week one. So hopefully we can get through all of my slides by the end of next week. The idea I have is when we get to the end, week number four, we're going to have kind of a, I guess you would call it a lab. So Tim Keller, I was telling Bob about this the other day when we were grabbing coffee. So Tim Keller has this idea that I think is quite persuasive, that people in the congregation, when a pastor challenges them to share their faith or invite them to church, the number one thing that's holding them back is two questions that they're terrified to get asked by people. And it's been my experience that that's true. I have a pretty good hunch what the biggest question will be, but I have no idea what the other question will be. So what we'll do next week is I will poll you. You can write down the two questions that you're absolutely horrified to get asked by people, and we'll work together as a group and everything that we've learned and how to answer that question successfully. So I have a feeling the number one is going to be our stance on sexual ethics. That's a difficult one sometimes to, and every single time I talk to people, usually you get up to that point, and sometimes that question gets asked. And I've come up with some creative ways to answer the question, but it's a really, really hard one. And I have a feeling that might be holding, some of us back. But I don't know what the other question would be, so I'm curious. And I'm already picking that one question, but I have a feeling that will be it. But so we could work through how to answer these particular questions. So just a review from last week. Session has talked a lot about this at our session meetings. So our three categories of people that might feel comfortable. And again, evangelism is broadly construed as worshipers. So we have new converts. We talked about that. That's kind of a no-brainer that we would want people that don't know the Lord to come to our church services. We have mainliners, which we finished up with last week. And this week, we have evangelical Christians. So, again, the idea is a broad perspective of evangelism through worship. So what are some things that we've talked about at the session level for why we picked this strategically to think through? So we should be concerned about generic evangelicalism has drifted towards the celebrity pastor. You know, Bob kind of gave a testimony of this last week, a church that they visited where the pastor was kind of the show, so to speak. My job as the pastor is not to promote myself, but to promote Redeemer Presbyterian Church, so no skinny jeans for me.
Jesus Christ.
Oh, yes, I'm sorry. That's what that's correct.
It's the CEO.
But I'm thinking of in terms of CEO versus church, so yeah. Therapeutic worship songs, which I know we've talked a lot about, so picking good songs, hymns in particular, that elevate Christ and his gospel, and not making discipleship optional. I think a lot of churches are set up to making discipleship optional, and it's actually not in the New Testament. So, and such so that the verbs that are used for conversion imply a continual ongoing process. It's not that you can just accept Christ into your heart and do whatever you please the rest of your life. It's a process. God does it and continues it. He who began a good work in you will complete it to the end when Jesus Christ comes back. So, as you can see up there, I have Hillsong versus Jeff Jeremiah. Has anybody seen Jeff Jeremiah in person before? He's quite a scary individual. So I was trying, when I went to General Assembly, well, I've seen him twice, once at a presbytery meeting, and Sarah walked away. Mexican culture, sometimes you have an affinity to, I wouldn't call Jeff Jeremiah a strong man, but he knows his position, and he's sure of himself, I'll just put it.
He's intense.
Yes, intense is a good phrase. So we walked away from that presbytery meeting where he talked for like 2 hours, and she said, I really like that guy, and I know we're in really good hands in Jeff Jeremiah. So if I was a betting person, I would take Jeff Jeremiah over Hillsong United, so with all the cool people up there. So that's kind of how I'm juxtaposing evangelical Christians. So before I say Erie is behind on the times, that's not necessarily true. We just got a... But I'm talking about in terms of current trends. So, although I'm shocked that I've been going to a bubble tea place on State Street, we didn't have a bubble tea place anywhere where we lived in Mount Lebanon or in the South Hills of Pittsburgh, and that's pretty cutting edge and it's really good. So, cutting edge there. But what's interesting is when I've been talking to young couples that have been visiting us specifically, I tried to pitch it out there. I'm like, well, why are you coming to our church? And they talk about being drawn to a traditional type of church, going back again to the broad, generic evangelical movement. I said, were you kind of dissatisfied with what you could call a youth group type of culture? I kind of realized this one day. It felt like I was always going to youth group. And they said, yes, that's exactly what it felt like. And I said, okay, well, we're intentionally trying to build a church whereby all ages are discipled, and we're not trying to stunt your growth, so to speak. So I would pitch it to them and say, do you think being reformed and liturgical is something that is drawing you to? And they said, yes. So, and I also mentioned this because Dallas, for example, when I lived there about a decade ago, this new trend of liturgical was really starting to take off. When I was in Pittsburgh, about 5 to 7 years afterwards, it started to take off. And my hunch is, now it could just be people don't know about us and we need to get our word of mouth out there, but my hunch is that we could start seeing that type of thing happen too. So don't be shocked if people are looking for that in a particular church. And I'm optimistic about it. So, and we've seen a few young families start to visit that are interested in that. So the flickers of hope are there. So I think they'll just be naturally drawn to our tradition. So, and then we've talked, I know our core group has always talked about this. RPC is the only evangelical Presbyterian liturgical church, so to speak, in town. So that kind of makes us unique. So even in a big town such as Erie, we're kind of it there. So that's actually a good thing for us. So again, acquiring the skills to think through people's questions, you can pitch this to them and try to persuade them to come to worship with us if they're dissatisfied with their current church perspective. So D.G. Hart, who's kind of my favorite evangelicalism scholar. I've been reading books by him and articles and stuff. He has actually a famous statement that evangelicalism is everywhere but nowhere, which I really think is kind of funny. So it's kind of like everywhere, but at the same time, one doesn't really know how to define it. So what if we conceived the Reformed tradition as having its own kind of like ecumenical place within all of Protestantism? I think this is true. So Baptist, I couldn't find, and I learned this in church history at Dallas Theological Seminary. I had a church professor who said, who put all the denominations up and kind of basically said one thing that they do really well. And that was kind of the broader gift back to Christianity at large. I thought it was a really cool idea of thinking about it. And ultimately, I went to a Reformed Baptist church and became a Presbyterian because I knew Presbyterians take discipleship really serious. I often share the story that my mom will always say when she knew her Bible the best, it was when she went to a Presbyterian church. So that's the thing that I think Presbyterians are known for being really good at. So we shouldn't be surprised if Baptists get you saved. This is taking from Dr. Hannah's lectures. Baptists get you saved, or non-denominational churches. Non-denominational churches are Baptist. I haven't really met too many that baptize infants such as us. So, baptized, they get you saved. Presbyterians excel with discipleship in education. Episcopalians or Anglicans start schools. You can think of a lot of the really good boarding schools in the United States were started by Episcopalians, if you look.
Hospitals, too.
Yes.
Hammett was started by helping out the Episcopalians.
Okay, yeah, that's another thing to think. It's a little bit hard to compete with the corporations now, but yeah, churches did start hospitals. So, and the charismatics have a tradition of experiencing God in profound ways. So if you kind of, I think it's healthy for us to know our place in the broader spectrum and our strengths. So when we're talking to people, you know what Presbyterians do well. So to think of it that way.
Is it also important to recognize what we don't do as well? And
yes, that's correct.
Try to do those things better?
Yep, that would be correct too. Yeah, I didn't think of it from that perspective. But, yeah, that's correct.
Because we tend not to get people sick sometimes or to shy away from.
Yep, no, that's true. Yeah. So, yeah, we should change that. And hopefully the last few weeks I've been trying to put an emphasis on that. So, yeah, that is some pushback that I would give to our tradition and is even something at the General Assembly level that is alarming to a lot of our senior leadership, like Jeff Jeremiah. We average one adult conversion per congregation and the whole EPC, and they've told us before at the pastors that they would really...
Per year.
Yeah, per year. So, theoretically. But that's not necessarily true. I mean, you have a lot of smaller churches that don't have an adult profession for a long time. So, my guess is that it's probably skewed differently where there's a few churches that do evangelism really, really well and make up for other churches. So, yeah, that's correct. Thanks for pointing that out, Jim. But...
just a comment. The church we were at in St. Augustine, which was a PCA church, but didn't get one. They had poles in front on the stage, and they were like brightly colored something on it. And we didn't know what they were. And when they got to the baptism, and someone made a profession of faith, they took the bracelet off the person, I think, and put it on the. On the pole, and I thought, oh man, that's kind of creepy. That's like put another
notch in the belt.
Yeah, notch in the belt, put another swastika on the side of the plane.
Well, I think he put more than that because he said at one point that we've had three people come to Christ this week.
That's right.
Okay.
And
yeah.
So then he put three of these. I'm thinking, what does it, you know, what constitutes that? I mean,
but there's a church that takes evangelism seriously and sees it to be important to celebrate the fact that new conversions are occurring.
Yep.
And I think that...
So they're Baptists.
There were a lot of reasons why they were Baptists. But anyway.
So what I'm trying to do is we shouldn't apologize for transfer growth sometimes. Like, there's a culture in our denomination that I personally disagree with where you can have somebody that's dissatisfied with their church experience, really want to grow, and Redeemer would be a good fit. And we sometimes have people in our denomination or our presbytery that want to push back on all transfer growth. Now, if it's all transfer growth, that's not a good thing. Like, session has to... We have to think about that type of stuff. But I just want to always point out transfer growth isn't necessarily a bad thing. So, but, yes, we should have professions of faith, too. And we should be praying actively for people to come to know the Lord through our ministry here at Redeemer. So, okay, so again, the nonstop Baptist. I'm picking up Baptist. My best friend's a Baptist, so we have an accountability call every single week. So, although he's trying to push his church in a more what I would call Presbyterian mold, so... He doesn't have that type of culture there, I suppose, to say so. So again, don't be surprised or embarrassed if other people in town like our Christian formation programs and want to join our church. So transfer growth shouldn't be everything, but at the same time, if we're broadly construing it, if it's worshipers, transfer growth is okay. So in conclusion, this week, or for our first week, because we didn't get through the whole slide, I always think of Steve Jobs and how he went about designing everything in Apple. His premise was, I always hear people in business, they say, like, well, you got to, like, know what the consumer wants. And Steve Jobs always went about it the opposite way. He always said the consumer doesn't know what it wants. And Apple has, from what I've read, unless it's changed since he died, they've always had this mentality, the consumer actually doesn't know what it wants. So Steve Jobs in that way has made an impression on me, because I think the church is very much the same way. People don't know that they need the gospel, and we have the message of salvation that they need to hear. So we don't always have to, churches get into a weird place sometimes when they do it from a market-driven perspective, I think, sometimes. So we should just assume people don't know that they need to know Christ, first off, and they don't know, on my second slide here, that they need a pure and simple mode of Christian worship. And I think we really can offer that here at Redeemer Presbyterian Church for people. So always keep Steve Jobs in the back of your head, because he's always there with me. I'm an Apple product user. I like their stuff. Maybe I just want to be different, even though everybody has a MacBook now, I guess. Or it seems so. I'm just being trendy. Maybe that's the only trendy thing I have as your pastor, is I use a MacBook. But just think of that. I think that's really good advice, to really always think the way that he thought about things. I actually agree with him in business mentality. So, again, if we do not do a better job at broadly construing evangelicalism here at RPC, our inaction can threaten the longevity of our church. So I just want to be clear with that, that it does. We do need to pick up new members. We need to pick up new conversions here at RPC, because it does threaten the longevity of our church. So I want to be clear, as your pastor, that we need to improve a little bit at that. So that's why I'm trying to put an emphasis on the last sermon series this month on evangelism. Shirley's doing a thing next month on friendship, and I'll be doing something on missions in November. So churches that have pastors that kind of remind people about it, that I've been a part of, that experienced growth as a church, the pastor was always kind of in the back of their mind, reminding them what the mission of the church is. We need to see new conversions. We need to see people recommit their life back to Christ, and so forth. So we need to think about that and pray about it. And do we still have the goals papers on the back? If you didn't get one last week, feel free to pick them up and pray through them and think about them all the time. So, in conclusion, from week one, this is a commandment from the Lord. Evangelism is not optional. I didn't realize that until I actually worked closely through the Great Commission. It's a command. It's actually surprising how many commands Jesus gives us that I think we tend to just gloss over all the time. I noticed that a lot in Psalms, when we went over the Psalms a lot, that sometimes we tend to gloss over stuff and not really sit back and think about the commands that the Lord gives us. So there is a command to do evangelism. And anybody that's been to Presbytery meetings or interacted just a little bit with our denomination, there is a reason why they put evangelical in the front, so to speak. They wanted to intentionally put an emphasis on evangelism. So just think of it this way. This has been my prayer as the pastor. And it takes the pressure off from what I said two slides ago. If everybody just brought one family to Redeemer this year, we would hit the session's goal of doubling in size. That gives us a whole calendar year. And I think that's a pretty doable goal, if you think of it that way. If we just have one, each person is either they build a friendship with somebody that doesn't know the Lord and are having them over for dinner often, sacrificing time to spend time with them, sit down with them, etc. If it's just one family, that takes off the pressure, instead of when I say double in size, and we're still a pretty small church, so doubling in size sounds crazy, but at the same time, it's really, really doable, I think, and Session feels that it's doable as well. So that takes the pressure off. Think of it in terms of that way. One family per family union would really make a difference for our church, and we would hit our goal. So I think that's achievable. So I'd ask for your prayers for that. Okay, on to the next week. You guys are quiet this week. Everybody's depressed because we're in the desert room. I actually texted our friends that are coming today, and I put dessert room, so I did it again. And I had Mary Kay in the back of my head. The two S's are for double portion of dessert. So, yeah. So I messed up again. Okay, so week two is America's current religious landscape. So I like to put everything through the lens of idolatry. I think sometimes when we go through generic morality, that doesn't, it's not as helpful. So my thing has always been, why not cut down the whole tree if there's idolatry plaguing somebody's heart than just snipping the branches? So we're going to go about this way. I know I saw some eeks that, but I really do think that. Why not cut down the whole tree? I feel like often when we talk about our faith with other people, there's just kind of moral fixings and we're just kind of trimming the branches. But let's go after the trunk. So that is kind of how I do things. And I think idolatry is the sin that everybody commits, and trying to link it all the way back to idolatry is really, really helpful. So, and keep this at the back of your mind, but next week I ask you to write down two questions that you're horrified to ask. So if we're going to try to look at it through an idolatry perspective and role play how to answer questions that might arise. So hopefully these slides this week will help to give you some ammunition when somebody asks you a really hard question to fire back at them. So my hope is that you can be on the offensive and not so much defensive when people ask you hard questions. So prophetic witness. So I've used this word a lot, but I think I haven't defined it as well as I ought to. So I didn't realize until I Googled it how popular of a phrase it was. I thought I was being new and trendy and just came up with the phrase, but apparently a lot of people like to say prophetic witness, so I want to define it how I am unpacking it this morning. So the church, and then I have Stephen up there being stoned. So I think while we're working through the book of Acts, he perhaps is one of the best prophetic witnesses to what the church was all about in the first century, who laid down his life nonviolently as a witness to Christ. So, and I have a thing for Orthodox paintings, so that's where I stole it off of Google images. So the church transcends present order. It has its own gospel, modes of worship, religious symbols, and liturgy. So for those of us that have read James K. Smith's book, You Are What You Love, this stuff will kind of sound pretty similar to what he goes through. But the idea is that we witness to who Christ is as Christians. But to be a prophetic witness, we kind of have to know what we're up against as a church. So, Christians appeal to the world to come when they pray, "Come, Lord Jesus." That's actually what we're doing, whether we know or not. But we pray that the Lord would come and judge and establish his rule and reign forever and ever. So we need to learn to burn the idolatry away in our hearts. Okay, so one thing that I want to be clear is I am interpreting current landscape as in terms of post-Christian. And I've actually been thinking about this a lot when I take walks with the dog and just kind of wander around and let my mind wander. But it's becoming quite fast, I think. Even I'll talk a little bit about June. I was actually shell-shocked in June with Pride Month, how that really just overtook everything this past year. It just kind of like came out of nowhere, but how we really are starting to live in a post-Christian society, and it's kind of ramping up really fast. So I'm going to kind of talk about some of the idolatries that I see floating around. Rod Dreher wrote a book called The Benedict Option. I know a few of us read it. I've been reading his blog since Sarah and I got married, which is about to be 7 years. So I've been following his career for a long time. Don't agree with everything that he says, but at the same time, the one thing that I think the book does well, and his blog, that's the only blog that I read actually, is he really defines that we are in a post-Christian society. Although it still kind of haunts us a little bit, because there are so take justice, for example. Christianity has a embedded in within it justice idea that becomes secularized and becomes quite different, but it kind of borrows from the Christian tradition. So movements don't happen in a vacuum. They're influenced by what came before them. So we're a lot more of a product of our the world we grew up than sometimes we like to think. So I've learned that from studying history. Okay, so identifying idolatry. We become what we worship. G.K. Beale, he wrote a book about idolatry, and that's what I'm going to try to be pitching through. We become what we worship. So I'm trying to identify what we worship, or what other people will we worship it to. But idolatry really gets to the heart of sin because it's about improper worship. So not simply saying God said so or appealing to morality. So for example, cohabitation. What's the idol? So often I'll hear people talk about cohabitation, or they'll be like, well, it's wrong to do. Yes, that's correct. But at the same time, I want to know, what is the idol that's underlying cohabitation, and what would make somebody want to do it? So again, back to the tree trunk. It's a really fantastic book. Now it's blanking from my mind. I know the author's name, Rebecca DeYoung. Glittering Vices, she wrote a really good book called Glittering Vices, and that's kind of how she goes through sin. It's like a tree trunk of idols. Pride is basically at the tree trunk. And her idea in the book is, if you can knock out the trunk, again, you, instead of just pruning the branches, you can really do a lot of, you can really get away from the idolatry in your own heart. So what's the idol in cohabitation? So selfism, I've mentioned this before. So making myself the arbiter of what is morality, like what is true and what is not. That's really at the heart of all sins. Consumerism, I think, contract-based relationships. In other words, you could just break up with somebody freely if you want, without having a covenant, which what a marriage is. I actually think it does damage to girls in particular, because they're the ones that if the guy breaks up with them, it's just harder on them. Studies show that too, especially when kids are involved. And individualism. Individualism is a big one I'm seeing in younger demographic. The individual is the heart of what the universe is all about. It's all about me and selfism. So I see this all the time. So again, why not cut down the whole tree down instead of just trimming the branches? So we become what we worship. Any questions thus far?
If you're going to get to a more detail about what you mean by trimming the branches.
Yeah. Oh, okay. So sometimes I think our response when we're trying to share the gospel with them is like, just don't do that, which is fine. That's a proper response. But what I'd rather see us do when you're trying to witness to Christ to somebody that way, I would rather you kind of to go after the trunk, so to speak. And
okay,
get.
So talk about cohabitation. If you're talking to somebody, you can sort of say, that's a branch. Cohabitation's a branch.
Well, yeah, so I would actually I would go straight to selfism or pride. Me putting myself at, me being God, so to speak, I'd rather attack it from that perspective. I would rather leave the cohabitation out almost and just kind of talk about that. I think it gets to the heart of the problem a lot quicker. So this stuff's actually quite fun because one day I was talking with somebody and they were talking about this push to be like authentic and stuff. And I'm like, well, when you say you're authentic, everybody pretty much does the same exact thing. So I don't have any tattoos, so sorry if you have a tattoo, but everybody has a tattoo now. Everybody kind of dresses the same. Beards are cool, so everybody's got a beard. And he looked at me, and he's like, you know, you're right. Everybody is kind of the same. And I said, the real radical thing is to wear a shirt and tie to work and have slacks on. That's the new being against culture. So if you're a punk rocker, so to speak, you would dress up like you lived in the 1950s. That would be the more radical. But it's funny that people that buy into the dominant culture talk about being so radical when they're kind of not. So it's kind of funny, I thought. Sorry. Go ahead, Lisa.
Well, I was saying about the cohabitation thing, that it's like there's an element of fear there, too, the fear of what if this doesn't work out. But nonetheless, if you're living together as if you are married, then it still cannot work out, and it will be like going through a divorce.
Yeah.
Even though you didn't take the official steps to make it a marriage, you are living as if it is a marriage, so how are you protecting yourself? What are you protecting yourself?
Yeah.
So when you say selfism, what do you mean by that?
Simply just.
It means I can do whatever I'm feeling doing?
Yep. Or just making myself the center of the universe. I kind of see that as the major sin that's going on in our culture, by and large, right now. So, Roger Ayer, I'm going to mention him again. He had in his blog the other day, there's a lot of. I'm starting to see a lot of divorces pop up quite early. I just had a conversation on Friday with a guy I went to seminary with. He's been divorced twice already. Yeah, so this is somebody I went to seminary with, and I got this feeling before I took the phone call, this is what it was going to be about, because I'm like, why is he calling me out of the blue? But, so we were talking about it, but I was seeing all of this play itself out, so I was trying to ask him questions about this, about his second wife. I knew his first, I don't know his second, but it was all about me, me, me. So he said that when he was trying to make their marriage work, her response was, well, you're controlling me or something like that. And he's like, well, to make a marriage work, you have to die to self. You don't have complete freedom when you're married. But that's marriage, it rubs up hard against if that's the dominant motif in culture. But I also think there's a lot of people that are just burned by bad relationships too in the past. So there's a different perspective to look at it as well. So, yep.
I understand what you're saying here, like with your, you know, cohabitation, but in our interacting with unbelievers,
yep.
My tact is not to attack them because they're cohabitating.
Yeah, no, that's correct.
I mean, it's important for me to understand that what the real sin here is not the fact that they're living together. I mean, there are deeper issues that are, this is sort of the symptom of the deeper issues of pride, selfism.
Yeah. Yeah, so you, as a pastor, you'd want to attack those problems. Go to those instead of a problem like that.
Yeah, my approach, I guess, has always been the sense to love people into the kingdom and let God deal with the sin in their life. We have some connection with the church that basically you can't join the church if you smoke.
Oh, okay, it's interesting. Like,
okay, well, we all agree smoking is not a good idea. But maybe we can let God deal with the smoking and focus on things that are more critical. Cohabitation is important, and someone's cohabitating can't be in a position of authority, certainly.
Yeah.
But I've seen oftentimes growth. Someone comes to the Lord, and then through discipleship, Christian formation,
yeah,
worship, God begins to open their eyes. And so I think we have to be careful of challenging people. We shouldn't expect unbelievers to act like believers.
Nope, that's correct. Maybe that's what I'm trying to point out as well, or thinking that way through that as well. But I think sometimes, I do think getting to the root cause, not having faith in Christ, let's do that and then let the Lord take care of sanctifying. There's not perfect sanctification. There's some Christian denominations that believe or want to pray for a second movement of God in their heart where they will be perfectly sanctified. Methodist, sorry, half of my family's Methodist. They talk about that sometimes, and I'm just like, oh, I'm more part of the Reformed tradition. But yeah, I catch myself doing that all the time. I think I know better. I think I'm God. And I'm like, well, why won't this person do this? Or why won't they do that? And I remind myself, we're not perfectly sanctified in this life. So smoking is a good one as well. Okay. So next one. This one is really interesting. This is a book that I read. Called All Is Forgiven. She was a sociologist. I actually think that she retired now, but it's called The Secular Message in American Protestantism. And what she does, I don't know if anybody's familiar with discourse analysis. Has anybody heard of this phrase before? So basically you mine text and look for key phrases that pop up all the time, and then you go and you study those. They had a class at Dallas Theological Seminary called Discourse Analysis of the New Testament. Dr. Fanning taught it, and it was popular. I never took it. It's probably too hard for me. But I had some other friends that were New Testament nerds that took the class and thought it was really interesting. So she actually took fundamentalist type of sermons and liberal mainline Protestant sermons, put them together and did discourse analysis on it. And what was so interesting about this study in the 90s is it came back that they basically preached the same thing. So you would think, and these were kind of idols again, that kind of, or false teaching, so to speak, or telling half-truths that pop up that I read. And it was really alarming, but in many ways pretty interesting. So I say God is daddy. That's what she said, not me. Knowing that I taught somebody recently that God, that Jesus does tell us to call daddy, basically, Abba, so that's kind of funny. But she was trying to say that the transcendent God, which should be a part of our tradition, basically just got axed. And then you get this really, God is kind of like my buddy type of thing kind of popping up. And again, what's so interesting is people who say they're theologically conservative had just as much in common with the liberal Protestants, which I thought was really interesting. So mitigation of sin. So sin wasn't really serious. It was, I just screwed up. So that was kind of the common theme throughout these sermons. If you want the book, you're more than welcome to borrow it from me. I don't believe I'll be reading it anytime soon. So, or I can scan a chapter for you, but it's really interesting. And the last thing that was really interesting was the transformed self is the focus of the sermons. Not so much who God is, what he's done for us in Christ. Really good biblical preaching, but the transformed self becomes the focus of the sermons. So it's interesting that the results were basically the same. And then she also says that youth were catechized on bowling and pizza and both, because she's looking at younger people in this study as well. So
I'm just thinking about one reason that might be true is that our secular culture is borrowing so much from the Christian tradition.
Yep.
That the same words are used, but they are used in a different context. So if you find yourself in a mainline church, self-help, or in secular culture, I'll say, self-help is more, you know, might use the same techniques even. You just leave the religious language out of it. Whereas if you're in a more conservative church, you're going to see that as part of sanctification. Same goal, same values even, that you want to see as your character traits, but one of them is based on the Christian tradition explicitly, and one of them is based on it implicitly, but taking some of the Christian language out of it.
Nope, that's true. So I always have these things in the back of my... I'll write a sermon and I'll think to myself, am I doing exactly what Marsha Witten tells the people in her book not to do? So it's kind of like the Marsha Witten response. I have her in the back of my head after reading this book, and I'm like, you know, to be honest, I'm kind of guilty of doing this sometimes or in my Sunday school lessons. So I kind of like filter out what she has through her book to get a better picture. Yeah, I guess that's what I'm trying, what you said about using the same language and culture. Somebody could be, that's what's so difficult to witness to people.
The opposite's true, too, because what I've been thinking about is I'm on the same page with respect to my the secular culture about the things, many of the things that I are ideals for my life. What do I want my life to look like? Well, I'd like it to look
like this.
I want to live a life of significance and integrity, and I want to be trustworthy, and I want... So those are points of commonality where instead of rushing to the point of difference and saying, well, see, we have nothing in common, we should rush to the points of commonality so that we can establish those commonalities and then eventually get to those hard questions and see why they do filter out differently in the church.
Yep, that's true. Yeah. This is also kind of, it's good to think through it as a group because we can strategize together. Yes, Shirley?
The main difference is that the Holy Spirit is changing us into all those things. And secular culture is just mimicking
itself.
Something that they see or want to be. They're making themselves look this way. We're saying we can't look that way. We aren't that way. But only Christ can do that.
And we're considered holier than thou.
Oh, here, I'll give a good example of kind of what I'm trying. So the TV show Fargo, there's something with Presbyterian ministers liking the Coen brothers, so I'll admit that it's a common theme. Anyways, this is a really interesting TV show, and one of the seasons they have so the Coen brothers, they're just executive producers on this project, but the great thing about their films I love is the common middle-class people, just honest people, are always the heroes of their stories. They're kind of one of the few people that tend to do that anymore. But they always have this oddball character in their story that wants to get out of the small town and be out of the heroic. So in the one season, I can't remember her name. She was in Jumanji when she was a kid, the actress. Anyways, she, throughout the TV show, keeps talking to all these, all the heroes of the stories, the normal middle-class people. They probably are church-going people, too. And then she just keeps saying, I just want to self-actualize throughout the story. So it's interesting that she wants to go off and move, and she does all these terrible, terrible things. So it's this self-actualization. And she actually becomes the villain of the story in the Coen brothers' things. But I read a review of it, and I was really drawn to just the normal mundane, boring people as being the heroes of the story. And I saw her as somebody that was the villain, but the person who was the cultural critic writing the review saw her as the hero of the story, and not vice versa. So it's kind of an interesting TV show, and that's what I like about their films so much. They do a really good job writing about that, because there's not a whole lot of writers that I've read that think about the world that way anymore. So, yes, Lisa?
I was thinking, well, I wondered if Bob was talking about, like, the seven habits of highly effective. Were you talking about that kind of thing that's sort of copying?
Not specifically, I guess, but just common rhetoric of what's a meaningful life.
Yeah. And then on the last slide, what you had about but talking about yourself.
Yep. Oh, the back one. This one.
Yeah.
Go back?
I don't know, maybe that wasn't.
Okay.
I was thinking about Steve Skinner used to talk about contemporary church music. It's often thinking about yourself and,
yep.
and, you know, changing yourself, you know, how you feel about your religious experience as opposed to worshiping God, And even if you point that out the last time I did, kids, like, what's the difference content-wise, you know, and that's a generalization, but a lot of the contemporary music is more how I'm feeling, talking about the transformed self as opposed to just praising God through what the lyrics of the text says.
Yeah, so a good example. I don't know what the most popular, that is true, popular contemporary. Hillsong had a song recently named Who You Say I Am, I think. I listened to it. It's catchy. I just listened to it because it was catchy. I'm not the biggest fan of their music, but if you juxtapose that song with A Mighty Fortress Is Our God, which is a classical hymn that I was listening to a lot last night when I was walking the dog, there's a really big difference in how they're talking about God that way. Martin Luther's hymn makes you want to fall to your knees and pray to this God who's just totally other than and protects you. That's the whole great point of the gospel, that the God of providence can protect you through hard times. We were just talking about lightning bolts earlier, and Luther comes to the Protestant Reformation because he almost got struck by a lightning bolt, but that's telling that he felt that it was important to share that about his story, and you can see that in his marvelous, marvelous hymn. And if you juxtapose that to some other contemporary song, so to speak, you get a radically different picture of who God is. So the real irony, sorry, Jim, I'm kind of on a thing, I'll get to you. My best friend pastors a small rural Baptist church, and he's a good pastor, and he's doing a real good job, and he's working with people, and they're starting to change a lot. But he'll often, when we're talking on the phone, he'll say, my folks have more in common with Friedrich Schleiermacher, who's the father of liberal Protestantism, than they do with John Calvin, Martin Luther, the great doctors of the church. But they're at the same time, they also, quote, like, hold to conservative theology. So it's a really hard thing for pastors to work through. But so sorry to evoke Schleiermacher there, but but it's true. I like to see the big picture as the pastor and see how that's called pietism, influences other things. So sorry for the long rant there. Go ahead, Jim.
But isn't the transformed self the goal?
Yes, but in the discourse analysis, it's all about the individual, so there's no telos, so no end to be conformed into Christ's image. It's just transformed into having a better business or being a better dad.
It's not being transformed into something that's...
Yes, that's correct. Yes. Yeah, so I would put it this way. To be a better dad is to be transformed in the Christ image, but if you're always talking about being transformed into a better dad, then you're kind of missing the big picture.
That's a really good point, because I think that the bankruptcy of the culture is that they have borrowed the transformed self model, but they can't explain it. There's no reason for it other than I want to be better, but I can't tell you why this is better. And I think that's where our opportunity for evangelism is, that there is a reason why that makes sense in our context. Because Christianity gives a context for all of those things that we all share as goals, whereas otherwise they veer off course because everybody has a different view of what that transformed self looks like or what it means to be a person with integrity. And without any guidelines to sort of keep us on the same page, it just becomes noise. Everybody's transformed self says it's the same thing, but it looks very different.
Yeah, and that's what is a real challenge, because people use the same language as us, and we're kind of like talking past each other. There's a really interesting television show that goes after the tech crowd, and they do like this montage in one of the scenes where all the techies who are pointing stuff keep saying, I guess the big thing for people in the tech sector is we're making the world a better place. That's what they say in like all their missional statements. See, they're exactly like the church. But then I look at it and I'm like, well, you just want to make the world a better place according to what you want. And I think, isn't it more radical to, well, God is real, but to appeal to a higher authority and make the world a better place according to what he wants, not what I want as a individual. So
what's the basis of that?
Yeah.
So the beauty of what we have to offer is not some generic God, which is where things will go to when you want to get religious, but that God also takes on the same values that the person has. It just happens to be that they're the same. Our understanding of God is mediated literally through Jesus Christ, and we can see what it looks like to be a human who is a better, who is the model of what that looks like. And oddly enough, everybody likes Jesus.
Yep.
They just don't like his followers. And so there's nobody says, I don't want any of that Sermon on the Mount crap. That's obviously wrong. I mean, very few people, maybe Nietzsche is proof of it. Yeah, and so, I mean, I think that's a really interesting conversation point with our culture.
Yes. Okay, I'm going to skip the next slide. Okay, so the church is no longer, so I have Bob Dylan up there. I always think of his famous song, The Times Are A-Changin', when I think about this type of stuff, and the times are changing. But I have the church is no longer. And I, ironically, when I was looking back through this, I purposely picked a rural church because...
That's pretty rural.
Yeah, so what... Yeah. But rural church planting is actually something that's really needed. Some of the most unchurched people in the United States right now are actually rural churches, with a lot of them closing. So I picked an old church that kind of caved in there. So church is no longer relevant, which is ironic because, at least in my opinion, there's a whole movement in the last decade for relevancy. I don't know if the church is as relevant as it used to be. My pitch is kind of like make Christianity weird again. That's why we're going through Acts. I mean, people going to church and meeting with people in their homes and worshiping Jesus, that was pretty weird and got the early Christians into some trouble. Not because they were doing bad things and stuff, but it was weird to join a church, and I'm trying to think of it that way. Again, all back to the prophetic witness. So if you don't think I'm correct, there's been a general shift for how pastors are perceived. I think before pastors used to be perceived, and I can see this as somebody who's a younger minister, and how I get treated by older people, boomers and the silent generation, as opposed to Generation X and under. Pastors are, I don't know what people think I do in the demographic under the boomers. They think I'm just kind of like a motivational speaker or something. But there's a real respect for the office of pastor and boomers and up that I think has changed a lot. So I would say some of my older colleagues would say that as well. Okay, I'll give the best example. My grandmother, who's not a Christian, she was really, really, really thrilled that I became a Presbyterian minister. Like that was really happy. But she wasn't happy for what the proper perspective. She was happy because as a kid growing up in the North Side, to be a Presbyterian minister in the North Side meant that you made it, that you were a really respectable person in your community. And that's how she envisions the world. She's in her mid-80s now. But if you juxtapose that to what I see sometimes in my generation, a pastor is just kind of another person among many. So
some of that's their fault, though.
Yeah, yeah, that's true.
Come in dressed like a hippie or rock star.
Hey, we are rock star.
Yeah. I mean, they're already saying, and call me Pete,
Yeah, but even if they aren't, I mean, it's changed.
True.
Oh, so hospital visits are another thing. Going to see people in hospitals, you'll get more, it matters for the pastor to show up in an older generation, whereas I would be interested, I would have to almost shepherd people to say, you need to call me if you go to the hospital, like, you don't need to be anonymous through life, like, I'm your pastor type of thing, so.
After 9/11, Feldman Churchill and the business had me come and conduct just sort of a, not really a worship service, but a memory, memorial service, thank you. And it's kind of interesting in a business, you know, kind of setting. And of course, it was very voluntary, anyone who wanted to come. But afterwards, or some, when in the midst of that conversation, he said to me, he said, Jim, you understand that as a pastor, you don't get a whole lot of respect in the world. He said, in the church, people really look up to you and respect you, and well, they should. But he said, you know, it's really different in the business world. And he said, you wouldn't believe how people talk about pastors. He wasn't being judgmental or critical, just, you know, sort of, this is the way it is.
Yeah.
And it was in context of bringing me in, and you realize that you may not get the same kind of respect when you come into this workplace as you would when you stand up on, you know, Sunday morning.
Yeah, so I always have Marva Don in the back of my head, too. Sorry, I have many voices in the back of my head, apparently. Don't send that to Bob. Don't take that to the ministerial committee. And
no, I won't, Doug.
So Marva Don's always in, she had a book called A Royal Waste of Time, and I always think about myself in the context of where everything is going in my career, because I'm just starting as a pastor. I have to be okay to see in the eyes of the church, it really does matter that I'm a pastor. But to the rest of people, I could be seen as kind of somebody that's royally wasting their time and their life. And I'm okay with that. So,
I think a lot of that now has to do with the immorality seen.
Yeah, that's true.
Not only in the Catholic Church, but in the Protestant Church. So here you have somebody who's saying to you, you're living your life wrong. You need to clean it up. They don't want to hear that to begin with. And now you can look at the clergy and say, yeah, it's like you're telling me how to live my life when I see all of these people that have publicly screwed up. It makes it even more difficult.
Yeah. Nope, that's true. And then you see a lot of megachurch pastors who get busted for having affairs and stuff, and then they maybe are in a denomination, not ours, but in the PCA. Actually, one of Billy Graham's grandsons, Julian Tavakian is his last name. He just popped up a year later, got married to the person and started his own church, and now it's huge. And I'm just like, that's not fair. So, but the lack of accountability, even sometimes that's not wanted by clergy, is alarming too, because it's kind of they're part of the problem too. Yeah. So, the next one. Whoops, no, that's not right. The moral compass of America. So, the Protestant church really was, broadly construed, was the moral compass of America. I don't think that's necessarily true anymore. People look, and this is actually unhealthy, because there's a guy who writes, Yuval Levin, he talks about mediating institutions being at an all-time low in younger generations right now. Everybody wants to be, like, active, but their participation in churches and clubs and ethnic clubs, all of that type of stuff is all kind of at an all-time low. So what ends up happening is people look towards politics, for example, and the stakes get raised up really. Yeah, so before in America, traditional America was the church kind of was, I think, historically kind of keeping in check the political sphere, but now it's the opposite is true, so. If I hear one more person say the next election is the most important thing in the entire universe, I'll go crazy, because it's not. The world goes on. Sorry, go ahead, Bob.
Well, I think the next election is the most important.
second.
You know, what you're saying there, as recently as the 1980s, which I know was long before you were even...
86.
Okay. You know, I got a call from a guy who was a couple years behind me in college, and he went to law school, and he was now at, he was the, I couldn't believe this, but he said, you won't believe what I'm doing, I'm the legal counsel to the House of Representatives, U.S. House of Representatives Ethics Committee. And so he said, Bob, you won't believe how many people are coming to me, you know, to ask me all of these moral questions, because they know that I'm a Christian as well as a lawyer. And they were looking to him as sort of a fellow pastor, safe voice, because he was also a lawyer and could give them, you know, secular advice.
Yep.
But they were asking moral questions because he was a Christian, and that was the culture of the highest, most powerful people in the country. And I wonder if that's true anymore. I mean, to some extent, we still see tremendous, at least external, lip service paid to prayer and to prayer breakfast that all of the many of the representatives and so forth, but Congress goes to. So there's still the idea that that's true, but the values suddenly have shifted so dramatically that you wonder why would that still be true if you're saying that everything you believe as Christians is wrong and illegal. Why would we still look at you as our moral?
Yeah, that's correct. In church attendance, even amongst, I don't know, I've never seen a poll with representatives and senators, but one senator I know, Ben Sass, is a member of a PCA church, but I know he regularly goes to church and is involved, but I don't know if too many others are. And he talks about that. He says there's a few, but not too many, so.
I was thinking when you were talking about your reputation of the pastor not being what it was, I was thinking along the same line. Like, if you were a Christian in your workplace, if people knew that similar thing, there would be an element of respect toward you or your view or your perspective on something. Or, oh, you know, like, don't swear, be proper around this person because they're a good person. But now there's more of a mocking sense about evangelicals. So pejorative politically, the term evangelical. So I think Christians are kind of painted with a brush, just like of a lack of relevance.
Yeah.
I guess. And if you're saying if the goals are making the world a better place or saving the planet or being as tolerant as possible, if that's what we're trying to do better for in the non-church world, then of course you're looking or the politicians who aren't giving you the answers to how to save the planet from plastic straws and
Here's another thing that's pretty bizarre. Mount Lebanon, when I was on study leave, I went to the library there because I love their library. I guess maybe for nostalgic purposes. But I went there and I'm driving to go. I went to get lunch with Nate, Devlin, my mentor. And I'm driving on 19, and I don't know what this woman did to this guy jogging, but he apparently made him quite mad. He gave her the finger while he was running afterwards. And I'm like, what is wrong with people? Like, first off, why would you do that to her? I was always taught you'd never do that to a woman. Like, that's just something you would never do. No matter. Yeah, so it's like, is this the world I want my daughter to live? Like, she cut somebody off, and it used to just be like a guy. Being a man meant you just let it go, and that's just, but he. Yeah, so he's like running for 5 minutes and just giving the finger to her. I'm like, this is a very strange world that in Mount Lebanon, which is a culturally conservative community. So it was weird. I was shocked that I saw that. So, Tom?
This is Boston, but a pastor friend of mine, Carol himself, tells the story that he sat behind a car that said, "Honk if you love Jesus." And it was one of his parishioners. And so he honked. And the guy looked at him. He honked again. The guy gave him the finger. So he honked again. The guy gave him a finger. Then he looked back and saw it was his pastor. And later they were talking about it. He said, "Well, you put the bumper sticker on. If you love Jesus, I love Jesus." Interesting.
That's awesome. Yeah, so, okay, our time is up for today, so we'll pick up here next week. So, good conversation. That's kind of where I want to go, more of a conversational direction. So, be chatty the whole time next week. Not just, maybe it's the good coffee that we have that's really getting into people's bloodstream and wakes us up 30 minutes through. So, thank you guys.